one of the things which, you know, in terms of life itself, is trying to have a sense of where are we at, where have we come from, and where do we go from here. We're in a culture of death. That's pretty clear. How did we get here? That's not always that clear. See? And how do we go from here? In America, there were two decisions by the courts that were sort of very influential in bringing about a culture of death in America. On June 7th, 1965, there was a, I believe it was a nurse called Griswold, working for Planned Parenthood. And there was a case before the Supreme Court called Griswold versus Connecticut. And in December of 1965, the court ruled that the so-called contraceptive pill could be distributed. Before 1965, in America, you could not buy a contraceptive. Young people think that's a shock to them. Right? A shock to them. And the decision of June 7th, 1965 was that only married people were allowed to, in the privacy of their home, to use a contraceptive, namely the pill. It's interesting. The pill itself, by the way, they were experimenting on it on the women in Puerto Rico in the 50s. And they were not interested too much in the health of the women. They were interested in finding the results of did the pill suppress ovulation or not. And so finally, by about 1960, it had reached the point where it was suppressing ovulation maybe 96% of the time. They figured they could market it. Difficulty. In the United States in 1960, it was illegal to market the pill. So they marketed it under a type of health pretense, regulating menstrual cycles. And suddenly we had a million women in America with irregular menstrual cycles. Many, many women in Puerto Rico on whom this experiment was done received incredible side effects, even killing some of them. They began to allow the pill to be used in America under the pretext of regulating menstrual, you know, cycle. But in June 7, 1965, Griswold versus Connecticut, the court said they could give it to married adults. I guess by 1972, there was another Supreme Court decision that said unmarried adults could use it. I guess it was by the end, but close to the 80s, they said unmarried non-adults could use it. And by the 80s or 90s, they were bringing the pill into the school system. And in the school system, the way they always get it through the school system is through the health classes. Any parents who have any children in schools must check the health text, must check what is being taught in the health classes. Because it's in the health classes that you really run into difficulty. For example, they started what they call health-based clinics in the schools. Now, what does health-based clinics in schools have to do? See, the schools became, instead of teaching, you know, reading, writing, and arithmetic, they became places for social engineering, which they had a social agenda, and they're going to implement it without the parents' consent. But in America, the teachers act in loco parentis, in place of the parents. So you really can't give an aspirin to a youngster without calling the parents to say, I'm going to give an aspirin. However, if you change a classroom into a health-based clinic, there's a whole different set of laws that they don't have to call the parents about anything because the relationship is doctor to patient, nurse to patient. Suddenly, the 14-year-old child in the school is receiving condoms and contraceptives and actually can be brought out in America to an abortion clinic and be aborted without the parents even being informed. The child could go to school, and the person could end up the counselor bringing the child for an abortion. That's the reality. So what happened was there was this great push for not a legalization of contraceptives, but of it's the cure-all. It's the solving all difficulties, all problems. By the end of the 60s, there was tremendous physical repercussions on hundreds of thousands of women in America from the pill. So much so, they had public hearings in Washington, D.C., in which they were suing the pharmaceutical companies for not telling them what they knew were happening to this woman in Puerto Rico. From blood clots to all types of, like, 42 side effects. And so they said to the people, we're suing you for not putting this on. We're conscious of that recently, say, in smoking. The tobacco companies being sued because they didn't indicate that it could do this, this, and that. Well, the reality was that the abortion pill, it's suppressing nature, is it not? That is, if you're suppressing ovulation, you can't really do that without other side effects on the human body. That's the reality of it, you see? And so what happened was, by 1969, there were public hearings in Washington, D.C., in which women were outraged in America for being used and not informed and abused, and many of them being hurt. And so there was class action suits against pharmaceutical companies. Now, as a result, they went back into the laboratories. Went back into the laboratories, and they reworked the pill. The pill, when it first started, was high dosage, suppressing ovulation high percent of the time, but with incredible side effects on the human body. So in 1970, they went back into the laboratories and changed the makeup of the pill, that it only suppressed ovulation 50% of the time. But it would confuse the body. See, if conception takes place, it takes place in the fallopian tubes. And the cells begin to multiply, and after 5 to 7 days, the new life works its way down from the fallopian tubes into the womb. And in the womb, during the time of ovulation, the ovary sends a signal to the woman's womb to develop rich blood cells on the walls, the lining of the uterus, the endometrium. So when the new life comes down into the womb, those rich blood cells allows that new life to be fed, to be kept alive, and to implant on the walls of the uterus. If those rich blood cells are not there, it can't implant, or it dies of starvation. Either way, it dies. So they decided that they would have a makeup in the pill, low dosage, which would work in two ways, a double mechanism. One would be suppressing ovulation, but not with the highest percentage as before, less side effects on the mother's body, less suing of the pharmaceutical companies. But it would also cause the endometrium, the rich blood cells, to be shed at the wrong time. So that if the life was conceived and it came into the womb, it could not implant, or it would die of starvation. Many women don't know that to this day. They don't know and they don't understand the double mechanism. They're against embryo stem cell research. Why? Because it kills the embryo after it has, by removing the stem cell, you take this embryo and you're killing that new life 5 or 6 days after it has been conceived. But that's no different from what the pill does. See, so we're caught in this situation. We're responding against embryo stem cell research because it kills life after it has begun. And we do not yet even know, millions of women in America, that's how the abortion pill works. That's how the contraceptive pill works. Because they're not going to be sued. Now, in order that they would not be charged with an abortion, or that it would be considered an abortifacient, in 1980, they decided to change the definition of when a pregnancy begins. you and I take for granted, and you know, life begins at conception. You remember the year 2000, where they, with all the use of technology and computers, they broke the GNED code of life, and so it was an incredible accomplishment, and it was, that this original cell that was a result of the fusion of the sperm and the egg, the zygote, that this original cell had this information that beneath the 46 chromosomes was like 60,000 genes, and these 60,000 genes would tell the proteins what to do in the development of the parts of the body, and that this highly organized, irreducible organism with this incredible information, chemically, if you were to print out the information in that original one cell, it would take 800,000 pages. That's incredible. And everybody said, it's incredible. Is that true? Yes, it's true. It's an incredible accomplishment to break this down, this code of life, and to be able, we know genetically now, that you can, from the first moment of conception, say if it's a boy or girl, if you have enough money to make the test. We know that. And so what happened was, we take this incredible life, this incredible existing life, which is irreducible, complex organism, which is self-directed. We don't direct that organism, tell it what to do. Within it, it directs itself. Which makes evolution a little bit of a difficulty. Because what you have is not chaos bringing order, chaos causing order. It's the reverse. You have a highly ordered, irreducible, complex organism bringing order where there was chaos. That's why many modern molecular biologists are asking that we rethink and relook at evolution. Because scientifically, there's a difficulty here. We seem to have found the opposite. We found this incredible, complex, highly organized organism, which we now can take and hand to people who have reason. You see, science cannot say there is a God. No, there isn't a God. It's not within its format. It's not within its formal object. But science can give to another science the raw materials of its findings, namely the science of using your intellect and reason to go from cause to effect, from effect to cause. It's called philosophy. And philosophically, St. Thomas Aquinas said, you can prove the existence of God through five ways. Via quinque, the five ways. And one of the ways you can prove the existence of God is through order. You have to say, how do you explain in this effect this incredible order in the universe? The one who causes the order is this highly intelligent being that must exist. So the intelligent designer type thinking, what you don't want to do is to say that you teach from science that there is a God. You get caught into that. Because you can't. It's not within the formal object. But science can provide to other science, philosophy, raw material that helps us to come to the awareness that you cannot explain this deductively, effect to cause, except by proclaiming there has to be an intelligent intelligence behind this highly ordered, irreducible, complex organism called the zygote that is self-developing, that causes order where there's chaos and maintains that order through your whole lifetime. In other words, the genes tell the proteins what to do and produce all the parts of your body. Now that's important, because in the year 2000 we said, that's there? This is real? Yes. And now we want to say that it's a nothing. It's not even human. You see, in other words, don't get caught into human life being human on the basis of how it looks, on its quality. It's not yet human because it doesn't look human. No, it is genetically a human life from the moment of conception or it never will be a human being. In other words, the cells do not change. In other words, you have to have the makeup of genetically of human life in the moment of conception, or it never will become. So don't get caught into quality of life arguments. The quality of life argument is you're describing it. You're talking about its quality. No, no. It is human or it is not. And if it is human from the very beginning, there isn't a pre-human zygote or something. It is a human zygote. It is a human embryo. It's not a pre-human embryo. It is a human embryo, a human zygote, a human life in the beginning, or it never will be. Just as the Holy Father John Paul II, before he died, he said, stop calling people who are grown old in a vegetative state so that you dehumanize them, depersonalize them, and then you can kill them. But you must do that first. You never become a vegetable. A human being is a human being from the first moment of conception until you die. Doesn't make any difference what you look like. Doesn't make any difference what is the quality of your life. You are a human being. You are never in a vegetative state, a vegetable. Right? When you say a vegetative state, a vegetable, you have now reduced a human being to less than what it is. See, that's almost an evolutionary type thinking. That you evolve into being a human being, and then you stop being a human being, you evolve back out again. Okay, so you have to be careful of taking evolution and applying it to man, so that you can change and fool around. Now, why would you do such a thing? Because if I want to experiment on human life, you may find problems if you say I'm killing a human being, but if I say to you, it's not human yet. What do you mean? Well, come on, it's just a blood clot. It's just this is that, you see? So what happened was, in the 80s, they changed the definition of pregnancy. And they said pregnancy, begins with implantation. You look it up in the medical books, you'll find that. Before 1980, pregnancy was the moment of conception. Now they make pregnancy the moment of implantation. But if you look in the small print of even the medical textbooks, you'll find something. What it will say is this: an affirmed pregnancy is implantation. An affirmed pregnancy, because everybody knows pregnancy has to begin with conception. Right? Now, why would they say an affirmed pregnancy? You know the morning after pill? They call it the morning after contraceptive. That's a joke. It's not a morning after contraceptive. They say, you must take it within 72 hours. Why does 72 hours? But before you take it, we give you a test. And we test to see if you're pregnant. If you're pregnant, we don't give you the morning after pill. Only if you're not pregnant do we give you the morning after pill. Well, here's my question, first of all. If I'm not pregnant, why are you giving me the pill? Right? This is question. Why do they say they don't give it to you if you are pregnant? Because the morning after pill would be useless at that point. Why? If a woman goes in to find out she's pregnant, they don't know. What do you mean they don't know? Well, sometimes they give a urine test. You go into the life center, but you get a urine test to find out she's pregnant, right? And it shows up in the urine. But early on, you won't do it. So they give a blood test. But even with a blood test, it will not show up. Why? Because the child is conceived in the fallopian tubes. It multiplies the cells into a blastocyst, you see, an embryo, and it works its way down from the tubes into the womb. And until it implants on the wall of the uterus, the child sends into the mother's bloodstream substances that says, I'm here, that can be picked up by a blood test. And until the child does that, you do not know if the woman is pregnant, although she may be. The only one that knows is God and the child for the first 5 to 7 days. So when they say, we don't give the morning after pill, if we test the woman and find out that she is pregnant, it means it's already implanted in the wall of the uterus, and it has sent the message to say, yes, I am here. If the life is already implanted on the walls of the uterus, you cannot use the morning after pill. You have to use the RU486. The RU486 pill is a chemical that will destroy the child up to 12 weeks inside the mother, even if it's implanted. If it hasn't been implanted, it may be there. They know that. Because it takes 72 hours or 3 days, you see, to make its way down. So when they say, we're not giving the pill if you're pregnant, it means we already know it's implanted. The pill would do nothing. But if the life is still there, you come 72 hours after having relations, the life is there, the pill can remove the rich blood cells on the wall of the uterus, and so the new life will not be able to implant and continue to exist or be starved to death. So the morning after pill actually is a chemical abortifacient. And they give it if the woman, if it's within the time span. If it's not within that time span, then it's useless. Or if it's beyond that time span, you have to use the RU486. So I give this to you because this is part of the culture of death. You have to know what you're talking about. You see? And so the morning after pill, if you look and go to an abortion clinic, you'll find the truth. Because they will list ways of abortion. RU486, surgical abortion, morning after pill. They tell the kids, if you had sex, be safe, come in and get the morning after pill. Well, it's too late. What do you mean it's too late? No, it is too late. If you're pregnant, you're pregnant. But the morning after pill will make the first home, the first residence, the environment so hostile to the new life, they'll not be able to survive. He'll die of starvation. So what happened was this. In order that you would not eliminate their experimentation in the laboratories, that you would not eliminate contraceptives, that you would not, because 80% of the contraceptives now work on destroying the environment as well as suppressing ovulation, that in order that you would not stop all of this, they had to change the definition of when pregnancy begins. And so they said pregnancy begins at implantation. Not before. But if you look at the small print in the medical textbooks, it will say pregnancy begins at implantation, but they call it an affirmed pregnancy. Namely, we know you are pregnant at implantation. Before that, you may be pregnant, but we do not know it. We cannot affirm it. See, it's a schizophrenic type thing. So, in order that you may, that they might be able to continue their experimentation, they make these so-called Freudian distinctions and schizophrenic approaches. But it's important for us to know, okay, what it's about. So, in 1973, as you know, in America, suddenly we had seven men, women's rights, seven men in the Supreme Court decide that a child could be killed up through 9 months pregnancy in the United States for no reason. We became the worst culture of death in the world. 9 months for no reason. There were two decisions came down the same day. There was Roe versus Wade, Roe being a young woman called Norma McColvey, whose child already was born. She never aborted a child. Her child is a daughter who's pro-life, as is Norma McColvey today. One of the helpers gave to Norma McColvey in Dallas, Texas, a rosary bead. She worked in a clinic in Dallas, Texas. We gave her a rosary bead, which Flip Wilson, who was the Protestant minister, wanted to take away from her, but she would not give it. And she said she came home to her mother Mary. And Father Robinson, Dominican father in Dallas, Texas, who helped me to start the Helpers there many years ago, he brought her into the Catholic Church. And Noel McCovey, who's Roe, is incredibly pro-life and goes all over the world trying to proclaim the sacredness of life today. This is the truth. See? Sandra Connell was Doe versus Bolton, came down the same day in Georgia. She was a young girl whose children were in foster care. And they said to her, if you claim you want an abortion, we'll get the kids out of foster care for you. So she claimed it. She didn't know what she was doing. Right? And they used that decision that you could have an abortion for any reason, psychological, emotional, whatever, namely on demand. And both of them are pro-life today, as was the founding president of National Rights Abortion League, NARAL, who established the first freestanding abortion clinics apart from the hospitals. His name is Dr. Bernard Nathanson. Dr. Bernard Nathanson and I were at odds with each other in the early 70s. We were arrested together in January of 89 outside of Planned Parenthood. And he was baptized into the Catholic Church by Cardinal O'Connor on the Feast of the Immaculate Conception in 1997. But he would not come into the faith until he was convinced that contraceptives were wrong and he would not give another contraceptive. This is the man who was the president of NARAL, the one who started the freestanding clinics in the world. But once they became converted, they were blocked out. They were no longer to have a voice. They no longer to be heard. He produced books. They put one book on the shelf. When that one book was sold, no other books replaced it. That's why you have so many pro-life newspapers and correspondents, because you could not get the message into the media. The media was overtaken. And so the people had to themselves to produce it. So by 1980, what had happened was they changed the definition of when pregnancy begins. And you say, what really was the consequences of allowing a person to have an abortion or someone to use a contraceptive? Why was that so devastating? What was what was the great effect? Well, basically it is this. This year, on July 25th, it will be 40 years since Paul VI issued the encyclical Humanae Vitae. 40 years. And he was rejected even by many bishops and priests and Catholics. And if you read that encyclical Humanae Vitae of human life, in section 17, he prophesies what would happen if this was rejected. Read section 17. It's descriptive of our world today. Incredible. Descriptive of our world today. See? What was the significance of this giving of a contraceptive or an abortion? It was this. Here's the great problem. It wasn't that you were simply saying someone could use a contraceptive, someone could have an abortion. It was saying something much more profound. It was the end of Western civilization. It was an attack on the whole understanding of how you look at the world philosophically and theologically. Namely, when you are saying that you can use a contraceptive and separate, you see, within the woman's cycle, there's only one day in the course of the month that a woman can conceive. It's only one day. Ovulation takes place one day in a cycle. And it's not even for the 24 hours, many say, but it's 24 hours, period. There isn't a special mucus present. If the man's seed is there, within hours it will lose its ability to fertilize. If it is present, it could keep the sperm of life of the man's ability to fertilize maybe 72 hours, tops. But that's it. Only one day in the month can you possibly can she conceive? Okay, and yet we give women contraceptives every day of the month, which are harmful to their bodies. We know only one day of the month is it possible to conceive. Think of that, just medically. And we know that it's an incredibly harmful effects that it has. 42 side. If you look at the small print, where the concept, 42 side effects. Devastating to the woman. But the reality is this, that by God's design, the purpose of marriage is twofold. Rather simple. Boy meets girl, build up friendship. They have common interest. They start to have more and more of doing things together, loving each other, growing. And finally, they want to give themselves totally to each other, including their life-giving powers, the gift of fertility. And they do this ultimately in the context of agreeing to accept the consequences of that act and to give themselves totally to it and to be faithful to each other and to do it with God. You see, no one gets married on their own, because marriage is geared towards life, and it requires God. So God calls a man and a woman together. God brings and creates marriage. He brings the two together. God made the male and female. See, God made us in His image and likeness. That means every one of us are equal, man and woman, in the image of God. But He made us complementary. He made us complementary, male and female. But He also made a male and female that they would come and be called by God to the marriage state. It's God's creation. And they're called by God to cooperate with God in bringing a human person into existence. Now we got the idea what sex is. Sex is to bring a human person into existence who is called into a loving relationship with their parents and with the triune God and to live forever. This is holy. This is sacred. This is something beyond belief. That this couple then would increase their love for each other by God's design. Most of the cycle they couldn't conceive if they wanted to, but to increase and to nurture the unitive aspect, the loving aspect, God made them that way. But there is a short time in that cycle when life could be conceived, and you cannot deliberately shut out life and God and play that you are the arbiter, that you're the creator, that you can change what you are and do what you want. Because when you do that, you've then rejected God as the source of life, God as the creator, God as the one, and we as the stewards of creation. We as the ones who, with our mind and reason, and God helps us to understand who we are and to act in conformity with our nature of how God made us. And so, Paul the Sixth said that when you separate deliberately and shut out God and life deliberately, you've changed your nature. If you act according to your nature, we call it the natural law. That's what it is. The natural law is not something you make up, not something you can disregard. It's something, that's how what you are. And with your reason and your mind, you reflect on what you are, and you act according to what you are, and when you do, you get happiness, perfect results. When you go against your nature, whether you know it, whether you do it knowingly or not, you're gonna pay the price. Eat the wrong foods, you're going to get sick. It doesn't make any difference whether you have the best of intentions or not. You're going to destroy yourself. You're going to perish. And so when you act according to what you are, the natural law, and what Paul the Sixth is saying, this is how God made us. This is the purpose of sex. It should be integrated into, it should be a personal thing. Integrate into a person in which one person is saying to another, I love you and I give myself completely to you, and out of this love with God, a human person, God willing, comes into existence who is to be forever, who is to love us and to love God and to be forever. This is the wonder, the mystery, the beauty of sexuality as understood by the church and taught and understood by God. When you take this act and eliminate God and life and true love, See, in other words, if it's an act of love, it's an I love you. Sexuality is integrated into me as a person, and I'm giving myself totally to the other. I and you are irreplaceable. But when you make the purpose of sex to be pleasure, deliberately, excluding God, excluding life, anyone can do. And you don't have to really, why get married? For what? And you no longer can argue against homosexuality. On what basis? Could you tell me? The moment we separated sexuality deliberately from life and from God, you no longer had a basis to argue against sexuality, homosexuality. On what basis? You don't like it? Tough. If you say it's a disorder, it's not in conformity with nature and how God made us, and has to be fought against, now you're in business. But once you went down the route of the contraceptives and made the contraceptives to be natural and the purpose of sexuality to be pure pleasure, that's what it becomes, no matter how you argue it. So young people say, why should I wait to get married? For what? And young people say, you're married, and you said you're married, and because you exchanged this gift of yourself totally, including your gift of sexuality and fertility with each other, you have the right to do this, but you don't do it. You break the covenant. So why should I, a young person, wait to get married? We'll just use contraceptives. And so you had premarital sex. And parents had difficulty telling young people not to wait. To wait for what? They had all the contraceptives in the house. Wait for what? Why? Then you had difficulty when you started to say to the church, we're going to follow our conscience. Don't tell us what to do. See, the idea of choice started in the Catholic Church. Pro-choice. In which we started to say, who's the Pope to tell us? We're going to follow our conscience. And what happened is when you separated this act of life and God from this human act of sexuality and love, making the purpose of it simply pure pleasure, it was no longer I love you, and it's a gift, total, complete openness towards life and with God. You opened up the door to homosexuality. You can't argue against it. I'm sorry. It's all emotions. But if you say, look, I have to conform my life as a married person or as a non-married person in terms of chastity to wait, and even when I'm married, marital chastity is difficult, it's demanding, it's holiness, you see? Then I can say, this person may, God loves the homosexual, person with this inclination, God loves the person who has difficulty with drink, a person with difficult fornication, adultery, but they have to, with God's help, conform to the order of how God made them. That's the way it is. And once you say there is no disorder, and you cannot say there is a disorder if you are for contraceptives. It's as simple as that. You've lost your grounds of argumentation. And so it was contemporaneous with the rejection of Humani Vitae was the growth of homosexuality throughout the world. Throughout the world. No longer would people have to fight. In other words, and then also fornication, premarital sex, right out the window. Right out the window. Most young people, they don't get married. They've lost the sense of working with God, being called together in this mystery. See, sexuality is visible and invisible. It's visible, it's this human, this act of love and sexuality, but it's also invisible in that there is God and this human life and person and all this mystery that is to come from out of this act. Now, the consequences of all of this, of course, is devastating. It's devastating. And it was devastating because, you see, on the one hand, we were playing God. So we are saying there's no order, no design, no plan. We make it, we create it, we go the way we want, and it ends up in absolute chaos. See? When you allowed a person to have an abortion, what did you do? You said you rejected that God is the source of life. God gives life, God takes life. No one else has the right. No one else has the right to take innocent human life. I said innocent. You can argue the state has a right to defend itself against irrationality. And it does. It's called capital punishment. Capital punishment takes place all the time. If somebody's killing people, the police go out to try to stop them, they shoot, and they could kill the person. That's capital punishment right on the spot. What the church argues about is that if a person is restrained and you have prisons, should you kill the person or should you try to restore them? That's a different thing. But per se, the state has the right to defend itself against total irrationality. It's called capital punishment. If the person is restrained and you're in a civilized situation, should you not try to restore and reestablish the personhood of the person? That's what we're talking about, see? But when you have abortion, we're not talking about a person who's lost their right, a person killing someone. We're talking about an innocent human being. It's life being taken. And someone giving them the authority to do so that is not God. The Supreme Court. The government. You have substituted them for God. And they give it not on the basis of, you see, when you hold that God is the source of life, you say life is an absolute value. It is an absolute value, the sanctity of which, no one, there are no exceptions. Doesn't make any difference what their condition of life is. There are no exceptions. Everyone has a right to life. The quality of your life can differ. Everyone has a right to basic quality of life. Do we all have to be multimillionaires and heavy? No, that's not necessary. It's not important. But everyone has a right to life. But when you suddenly changed and said no, what determines your right to life is the quality of your life as determined by others. That's what Roe v. Wade was. It was never about is it a human being or not. That's nonsense. Long since discarded, and everybody knows it. It was the changing of this basic principle that life comes from God, and because it does, every life is absolute in its value and is holy, and no matter what its quality, no one has the right to take another human life. And that was changed upside down. We became God. The courts decided who can live and who may die depending on the quality of your life. So, you see, the significance was not simply that someone could use a contraceptive, someone could have an abortion. The significance was an abortion was we were taking away this basic principle of Western civilization, of Christianity, that life comes from God and only God gives life and God takes life, innocent human life. And it does not depend on the quality of your life. That became the opposite. And that there is a design and a plan in God that we must conform to, namely to act according to our nature, and if we don't, we perish. That's what a given a contraceptive is. Very simple. Profound. It's devastating. Because we're playing God and acting against our nature and we will perish. And so we became more and more man-centered. We can do everything. And it became productive in our educational system. In looking at viewing people. A person was as valuable as they were productive. When they became unproductive, they were no longer valuable. As opposed to, and our whole system was to educate people to make a living, not to educate people how to live. Because we lost the purpose of living. We lost the purpose of how to live. We rejected the design nature. We rejected God himself. And we became totally man-centered. And so as a result of this, we then further increased the idea that you can't know truth. Truth is relative. It's subjective. And so we said you shouldn't impose your truth upon anyone else, your morals upon anyone else. Positivism. Ethical relativism. And if you hold those truths, then what do you have to do? You have to remove all values from the law. And so every law that has a value, the courts found it to be unconstitutional. You're imposing your values on someone else. And so ultimately, instead of law being the place where one generation passes on to the next generation the wisdom of how to live, it became the source of chaos, because we reduced society to the lowest possible moral values of any person in society, lest we impose our values on anyone. And chaos developed. And the court's decisions, one by one, kept taking the values out of the laws that were put there over the centuries and handed down from our forefathers to us of where wisdom lies and what, where wisdom is how to live and how to live wisely. And so we began to create absolute chaos. And we absolutized freedom, with separated from truth and reason. We said you can't arrive at existence of a truth that could be agreed upon by all, a universal truth, and therefore no truth should be imposed upon anyone. And we started then to, as we disregarded God, to absolutize and to make a pursuit of material things, of the good life, almost a hedonistic, materialistic, consumeristic society. And we say, that's what we give to you young people. Well, what has happened is this. John Paul II, he knew the older people were hard of heart. Many accepted, many denied. Lay people, religious, priests, bishops. And so, wisely, he started to go to the young. And God had him for 25 years as Pope. And so he has a whole double generation. It's called the JP2 generation. In which they said, no, who will these young people listen to this old man? Yeah, because they were experiencing the effects of this civilization on their lives. They knew one out of every three of their brothers and sisters were dead. The classroom chair was missing. They were not in the class. They knew that when they were in the womb, this civilization said, for no reason, the mother could kill them. How do you respect the society? See, well, that's what happened. The bells start to go off. And so every poll in the United States today that is taken from anybody about 33, 34 years and younger, overwhelmingly pro-life. And whom do they flock to? They flock to JP2. I was at the World Youth Day in Cologne, 2005. And all the pundits, the media were saying, oh, they're not going to come, an 80-year-old man, Ratzinger, he's a strict, you see, something. 1 million young people were there waiting for his words. 1 million young people. That was John Paul II's gift to Pope Benedict the 16th. And the young people now understand the vision, the beauty of what was rejected. It's called theology of the body. Theology of the body was John Paul II from 79 to 84 on Wednesday afternoons. In his reflections, he reflected on sexuality and the man and the woman, and he spun out this whole really catechetical understanding of sexuality, and was termed the theology of the body. At the end of his lectures, after 5 years, when everybody was commending him, what a marvelous thing he had done, he said, I have only been reflecting on what Paul the VI said in Humani Vitae, and I didn't tell you that in the beginning because you would have rejected me. Interesting. But if you go back and you read Humani Vitae, yes, everything that's in the so-called theology of the body understanding is right there. So what has happened is this. There is reason for great hope. Let me tell you this. All over the world, young people are pro-life. Overwhelmingly. There are some exceptions. Some exceptions. But overwhelmingly, they are pro-life. And they're not pro-life, like, academically. No, they're pro-life that they're willing to go out and commit themselves. They're willing to do stuff. They're willing to stand up for life. They're committed to it. Because so many of them have been exposed to this so-called wonderful freedom that has been a cross for them. That has been a cross for them. You will have maybe 400,000 or 500,000 people come here, even to Australia. I say even, because it's very difficult. You know, in other words, in Europe, you have people, it's easy, landlocked. People can come from all different countries, get there. It's an easier place to get to. But you still will get 300,000 or 500,000 young people for John Paul, for Benedict XVI at World Youth Day. How do you explain that? How do you explain that? I came on the plane was absolutely loaded with young people. One plane after another landing, coming in, young people at the airports, one after another, you see? Amazing. That's because they hunger for the truth and they know where the truth is. The beauty and understanding of the church's understanding of sexuality, of person, of creation, of God, of the dignity of the individual, you see? They know it's true. And the culture that reduces the human being to a nothing, that you're important because of what you can do, not because you are. That you look at people and you judge them qualitatively instead of as the absolute value of the same. They reject it. They know it's wrong. They know it's crazy. And they know it's crazy. And they're hung in for the truth. And so what I say to you, there's this reason for hope, because the older people are pro-life and the younger people are pro-life. It's the ones who were hurt by this rotten culture in the middle are holding on, because it's too painful to say they were wrong or they were taken. So you have to be merciful with them and work with them. Now, at the same time, okay, at the same time, in the beginning in America, we tried to change things politically. And that made sense. The great effort was politics. The great effort was to change the laws, change this. See, but if you don't achieve that within a period of time, you have to change what you're doing. Because the law will change the culture. The law will change what the people are. And so, once you realize that... See, in 1968, what was under attack was family and the process of procreation. The church came out with the encyclical Humanae Vitae Paul VI and said, family is God's creation. Process of procreation must be respected. By 1987... what was under attack was life in the womb from conception unto birth. The church came out with Donum Vitae, the gift of life, sacred congregation of faith, and said that life is sacred from conception unto birth, and all the things that are being done in the fertility labs today, it dealt with and said it's wrong, basically. Because you're treating life as almost an animal, okay? You're playing God. Just as Paul VI said, you must not separate the act of sexuality and love from God and life. So in 1987, Donum Vitae, who was written by Joseph Cardinal Ratzinger, and God approved that document by making him Pope Benedict XVI. And what did he say in that document? He said, just as Paul VI said, you cannot separate the act of love and sexuality from God and life deliberately. Deliberately. See, that's the key word. It doesn't mean you cannot conceive every time you have relations. It's impossible by God's design. But God is saying, when you cannot deliberately shut God out. That's all. That's all. See, and if they allowed people to know exactly, with greater ability, exactly when conception could take place, you could put the contraceptive business totally out of business, but they make millions and billions of dollars. So there's a financial dimension here. So what happened is, by 1987... Cardinal Ratzinger, who signed the document, said, as Paul VI said, you cannot separate the act of love and sexuality from life. I now say to you, you cannot have human life apart from the context of human love and sexuality. Otherwise, when you grow life in the laboratories and you separate from that life human love and divine love, who knows, who cares? Who's going to protect that life? You can destroy it, you can experiment it, you do whatever you want, and no one cares and no one knows. See, when you're born in the context of a family, you don't have to pass a test to continue to exist. When you're born in the laboratory, you do not continue to exist if you fail the test. You have to realize that. Every child conceived in the laboratory is put under a pre-implantation genetic diagnostic test. And if you fail the test, if your quality of life is not acceptable to me, I kill you. We wash you down the laboratory sinks. You are not implanted. That's the law in England. It is the common practice throughout the world. And why? When you are born to a family, you don't have to prove to anybody that you're worth allowing to continue to exist. You're my child. You belong to me. I don't care if you're Down syndrome or not. But what has happened is you don't see any more Down syndrome children. Why? Because we now know what causes Down syndrome, and we kill them all. 9 out of every 10 Down syndrome children are now killed. Yes, it's the truth. Try and find them. There'll be less and less. And this is the way to go, this as I see it, because they're purifying the race. They're getting rid of the ones that would be a burden, the ones that should not continue to exist. They're almost pre-Darwinian thinking in the laboratories. Okay, 2 minutes. Wait, two minutes and he's got to break here. So I just want to complete this part. So what I'm saying to you is this, is that what has happened is the thinking here is that we have gone from a culture in which the individual person, his value has been totally devaluated because we didn't accept the teaching of the church first that marriage is God's creation and the process of procreation should be conformed with God's natural law, how he made us. That we shouldn't separate human life in the laboratories from human love, otherwise we have all types of incredible aberrations and perversions that we are now having. And finally, if life is not respected in the beginning and in the womb, it will not be respected all the way through, and so you have a great attack of, in 1995, the Holy Father John Paul II, Evangelium Vitae, said, now you have euthanasia, in which life after being born is now under risk unto death itself. And so he said, we have reached the point of a veritable culture of death, where life is under attack from the beginning to the end. And what must we do to resolve and to change that? And I'll tell you after this break, because he wants to change the film.
Oh, I believe in Jesus.